WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Virginia will pair housing construction assistance with business development under a new program. Appalachian Power plans to build a small nuclear reactor just east of Lynchburg. And we talk with Evan Friss, JMU history professor and author of The Bookshop, and special guest for our November Books and Brews. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, November 18th. The state of Virginia will help fund housing construction alongside major business development under a new program. WHRO's Ryan Murphy reports on the governor's recent housing conference in Virginia Beach.
Governor Glenn Youngkin says the state's successfully attracting new businesses, but that's only part of the equation.
And imagine announcing 500 new jobs in a community that doesn't have the housing to provide 500 new great job seekers.
Youngkin says the state desperately needs to ramp up housing supply to battle rising costs. The new Workforce Housing Initiative will spend $75 million over the next 5 years to help localities develop as many as 5,000 housing units specifically for workers near major employers.
Ryan Murphy reporting. Technology to photograph and read your car's license plate is not new, but after next year's General Assembly session, there may be new laws for how Virginia law enforcement agencies use that tech. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
They're called automated license plate readers, or ALPRs. They're high-speed, high-tech camera systems that not only take a picture of your car's license plate, but they also collect and store data from those photos. Charlottesville Police Chief Michael Kochis said they can help.
They've been in place now in Charlottesville for about 2 months. And almost immediately, we have started to see results.
Kochis spoke about his city's use of the readers during a recent meeting of the Virginia State Crime Commission. The committee had just heard a presentation about ALPRs, which detailed how and for how long the data is stored and who can access it. This long-term data collection of people who haven't committed crimes raised eyebrows for civil rights advocates like Ruby Cherian with the Legal Aid Justice Center.
These decisions that we're making not only set the parameters of ALPRs, but the parameters for the future of mass surveillance in the Commonwealth.
Cherian said Norfolk's use of over 170 ALPRs is already facing legal challenges. Floyd area delegate Ren Williams said it's easy to view such systems as, quote, Big Brother Overwatch, but he also noted many Virginia localities are already using them without guardrails from the legislature.
The horse is out of the barn kind of thing. And so I think that we have to get our hands around it, our arms around it right now.
An effort to add new regulations to ALPRs was pulled from the docket during the 2024 session, but Delegate Charnell Herring said she hopes to bring it back in January. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Appalachian Power plans to build a small nuclear reactor just east of Lynchburg. Cardinal News reports that the Campbell County site sits along the James River. An electric substation and access roads are already a part of the property. No commercial SMRs are currently functioning in the U.S., but this summer, Dominion Energy announced plans to build its own small reactor in Louisa County at the North Anna Power Station. A Democratic state delegate and a Republican schools activist won firehouse primaries in Loudoun County over the weekend. The Washington Post reports that the two will compete in a special election to fill an open Virginia State Senate seat being vacated by Democrat Suhas Subramaniam. Democrats nominated State Delegate Kanan Srinivasan, while Republican voters picked Tume Harding, a former teacher and vocal critic of Loudoun County school system. Subramaniam, a first-term state senator and former state delegate, is stepping down from the state Senate after winning the race to succeed Representative Jennifer Wexton in Virginia's 10th district. The Virginia Alcoholic Beverage Control Authority announced raking in about $240 million in profits during the 2024 fiscal year. The Roanoke Times reports that's almost $4 million more than the agency expected. Although some stores' revenue was lower than anticipated, ABC totaled about $1.4 billion in sales. Money from the agency goes toward health and human services, education and transportation, among other state programs. Well, finally today, for some people, a bookstore is just a place you go to find books. But for others, it's a special location for discovery and community. James Madison University professor of history, Evan Friss, writes about the history of the American bookstore in his new book called The Bookshop. He's our guest for tomorrow night's Books and Brews in Harrisonburg. WMRA's Chris Boros asked Evan to talk about his earliest memory of venturing into a bookstore.
We had these little village centers, they call them. They were essentially shopping centers. And there was a Crown Books in there, which was next to an independent video store. The bookstore was honestly slightly more off-putting to me, and I did feel somewhat intimidated walking in there at first as some kid in this place filled with books and seemingly people who were well-read. So it wasn't a particularly powerful experience or one that repeated often. And then a Barnes & Noble opened up, and I went there more frequently. But it really wasn't until I was much older in graduate school that I really started frequenting bookstores, enjoying bookstores, and thinking about the role of bookstores.
Yeah, there is something special about being in a bookstore. And I don't entirely know what it is, if it's the fact I'm surrounded by all these stories or even the smell of the books. There's something that like puts you in this interesting mindset. You're around smart people. What do you think it is?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is a sensorial experience. So some of it is the books themselves that are near holy objects to many of us that, right, we don't toss books in the trash. And
yeah,
part of it is the materiality of the books themselves, these beautiful books, but also, as you mentioned, the fact that they're full of stories and these portals to other spaces. And for many of us, bring back memories of reading as a child or imagining far off places. The smells, the texture, and I think it can be inspiring. We just have a sense that as humans, we want to learn things, and hopefully many of us can tap into that curiosity, and a bookstore is a place that I think can ignite that curiosity.
Is there a section of the store that you gravitate towards?
Mostly nonfiction, although I actually prefer to read fiction.
Huh.
But as someone who writes nonfiction, I guess sometimes I'm drawn to see if my book is in stock.
Sure.
So that's a very egotistical draw, survey to see if they have a copy of my book. I actually do like to browse widely, and part of the joys of a bookstore is the unexpected and serendipity that's associated with it. And I really love it when bookstores have not necessarily a miscellaneous section, but books that are put together in less obvious ways. And we as the browsers are kind of stumbling upon things that we might not otherwise. So if there's a section for mysteries or cookbooks or fantasy, I won't ever go in those sections. But sometimes I'll come across some book in that genre that I think is really interesting because it's on some table of, you know, noteworthy reads. And then I might be compelled to actually buy it.
Your new book is about the history of the American bookstore. Do we know the first bookstore ever opened in the United States? Can we trace that?
It's a complicated question. Yeah. I start the book with a chapter on Ben Franklin's bookstore, which is before there is a United States. It's colonial America, part of the British Empire. And his was definitely not the first. I do profile in the book some of the first known booksellers, including this guy named Hez Usher in Boston. And Boston was home to some of the first booksellers because it was also home to some of the first printers and people who were making books. But even then, most of the books came by way of Europe. Ben Franklin had a bookstore, but it was also a post office. It was also a place to buy chocolate and was a place for people to see books being printed. So this very physical space where there were kegs of ink lying around and papers dangling from the ceiling drying. So more just dedicated selling spaces emerged later in the 18th century and even more so in the early 19th century. And one of the first what I call modern American bookstores that opens is the Old Corner in Boston, and it opens in the 1820s. And one of the reasons I call it a modern store is because it was really meant to be a hangout, a place for people to come and actually browse and look at the books themselves. So many early shops had books that were behind glass walls, or you had to tell a clerk that you were interested in such and such a book, and they would fetch the book for you. So there was a real moat between the buyers and the books themselves. But in the old corner, not only were the books out on tables and display, but people were really encouraged to linger, and it became a hub of readers and many famous New England writers as well.
Evan Friss, JMU history professor and author of The Bookshop, is our guest for Books and Brews tomorrow night in Harrisonburg. Later today, during All Things Considered, Kimberly Daggy will have more from this interview. Learn more at WMRA.org. Full disclosure, WMRA's operating license is held by JMU's Board of Visitors, and JMU underwrites programming on the station. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Monday.